Hey, everybody. I know most of you out there like making money. I can hear the fingers rubbing together right now. But here's a really cool opportunity I wanted to share with you guys, and that's driving with Uber. Now, Uber's that popular smartphone app that connects riders with drivers. So, you know, as for me, I take Uber a bunch. I take it to work. I take it to the studio. I take it to pick up kids. I take it on date night. Most of the times I'm in an Uber, I have an amazing conversation with a lot of the drivers that are there. They're always interesting people from all around the world. Some things I've learned just in having conversation is that they love being their own boss. It's a great way to be an entrepreneur. If you're a student, it's a great way to go to school, have a part-time job, use your own vehicle, make some money. Even if you're a parent, it's a great way to get around. And in between taking kids to school and to camp and to soccer practice, you can always find some time to make some extra cash. So you've got a car and a license. Put them both to work for you today and start earning serious life-changing money. Sign up to Drive with Uber by visiting drivewithuber.com. That's drivewithuber.com, drivewithuber.com, and tell them Innovation Crush sent you. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush. I am your gracious host, Chris Denson. In case you're tuning in for the first time, you should know that this show is all things innovation, marketing, ideas, creativity, people who are inventing and reinventing the way we're doing things. And today, we have a really big show. I mean that quite literally. King Drew, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
You are well. I'm good. I'm pretty good. Andrew McGregor. Also referred to by your friends as Drew.
Yes.
So which I don't know which one I get to call you today, but I'm going to go with Drew. I feel like we're friends.
Yeah. You're going to remove my royal moniker?
Yes. And I'm surprised I didn't see the crown. Well, is there a crown, though? How about that?
There are many crowns, and I was going to wear it, but I knew we would have headphones. So I think it's rude to the crown to remove the crown.
Yeah,
once you've put it on.
You know, when I watch like hip-hop radio on YouTube, and it's like they always have hats on. I don't know how you do the hat and a do-rag and a bandana and headphones. It's pretty complicated.
Yeah, there's an art to that. I'll look into it.
Speaking of wearing many hats,
yes.
Look what I just see.
Boom!
You wear a ton of them.
Yes.
So I'm gonna ask you to try to abbreviate and give us sort of the 90-second version of who Andrew McGregor is.
Cool. Basically what I do and think and feel is I invent solutions to humanitarian problems and then start organizations and companies that help solve them. This kind of part of my life's journey began about 8 years ago when, with a couple of friends, I started an organization called the Tiziano Project, and that teaches journalism to people living in war zones in difficult parts of the world and parts of the world that don't have much exposure, including Indian reservations in America and South Central LA and stuff like that, as well as Rwanda and Mogadishu, Somalia, and parts of DR Congo.
Yeah.
And then from that, because once you start a company, you know, it's a power. It's like, haha, I can start more companies and they can do more good things. And then
more power.
The second company I started was very much inspired by Paul Newman salad dressing. Paul Newman has a whole line of salad dressing that just benefits a few environmental causes he supports. So I was like, oh, a product that supports an associated charity. Neat.
Right.
So kind of with that inspiration, with a friend, started a company called Graphation Comics, and that creates comic books that support associated charities. So, for example, we have a comic that we're helping to create coming up that's based on the story of this woman who grew up in East LA. It's her brother's story, and then her brother, after serving three terms, committed suicide. And it's the comic book's going to be about him and his life, and the comic will support charities that advocate for veterans' rights and work against veteran suicide. There's a little known statistic that an average of 22 veterans kill themselves every day.
Every day,
so you do the math on that, and that's thousands of soldier corpses in America from suicide. That's our next kind of big philanthropic comic that's coming up. But yeah, that's the idea, is that I'm
how do you make that enjoyable,
right?
from an entertainment standpoint, right?
Enjoy. I love I have a belief in the everyday superhero, right? So, like, superheroes all around us, and you can find them and glorify them in comic books. And I take great joy in that, and also in telling these stories. And there's a real dignity and empowerment in allowing people and helping people to tell their narratives when it's often shut down.
Right.
So in the case of, like, East L.A. veterans, you know, they're in East L.A. anyway, so it's not, like, the greatest amplified voice in the world. And then a lot of people from that community have served this country. And then to have kind of deficiencies in mental health services for veterans that's contributing to 22 suicides a day, it's a huge problem. So there's a great joy, I feel, in kind of assisting.
So the joy comes from, like, and I would assume that comes out through the work. Like, and I'll stick with this just for a second. Mm-hmm. But the, you know, this idea of a comic book in my head, I go, like, comic humor, but I know that's not what comic books are always. But just this idea of, like, presenting this in an entertaining light, like, what, you know, is there sort of a creative process that you take to it, and, like, tones and beats and to get the message out, but also, like, just make it digestible, fun, cool,
so
entertainment?
She's writing the story, and so she has keynotes of her brother's life that she wants to be included. And so to make it comic booky, we're considering entering or inserting kind of fantasy realms, like, do we have, like, supernatural moments or, like, the ghost of his brothers are assisting him at various points in his journey. And then he, you know, helps his brothers from beyond the grave type of thing. So to kind of give it those fantasy elements.
Kind of remove, give it a couple of layers of separation from reality in a sense, but also just, like, make it cool.
Yeah. To make it cool and kind of fit it within the tropes and archetypes that the comic book reader is accustomed to. We're playing with, but things like that would come into play. I'm not sure what it'll be for this specific comic book, but his sister is writing it, and so we're just kind of guiding that story and then connecting that story, like, just doing the business know of, like, here's how you establish an entity that'll, like, fund these entities, and, like, is that an umbrella foundation that you would channel the money to, and blah, 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 and stuff like that. So, yeah.
So, when I go down your list of achievements, there's photography, journalism, chess boxing is a thing you're well known for, this comic book stuff, you know, and you mentioned a minute ago, like, there's this thrill of creating an entity, creating a, like, where is the passion point for you? I get the problem solving part of it, you know, from the philanthropic perspective, but from the actual making it happen, like, is it, like, what's the thrill of the hunt of creating these organizations?
Yeah, I don't know if I get the high of a lot of entrepreneurs who are like, RIPO is coming. Yeah, let's go to Vegas, boys. That's not really
Series C.
my
I'm
joy...
throw a Series C party one day. Even though I don't get one, I'm just going to do it anyway. Just ball out.
Oh, you
and
must
not pay the bill. Let me get 40. Let me get 5 bottles over here again. I was like, where'd that guy go? Sorry.
So, like, where the joy comes from, the consequences, and, like, seeing kind of institutions that I've created and helped create kind of resonate and echo through the world. Like, a very simple example is on my Facebook page, a lot of my students are now connected, and some of them were born in Somalia, others, you know, are in Ethiopia, others are in Congo, and kind of through the journalism programs I helped establish, they're all, like, connected, and they're all, like, helping each other in their careers and grow like that.
Right.
And that's, you know, it's because it's often, like, hard to, like, quantify, like, what's your significance in the sense that, like, a straight corporate cash flow sense has. But when you see those connections and you, like, realize that, yeah, I was the linchpin, and, like, all that effort created that linchpin hub that allowed this other kind of, to me, like, almost impossible things to occur.
It is impossible. Even in that example, you know, I think about, like, I was able to do a project in Africa a few years ago, and, you know, was helping to implement a UN policy for persons with disabilities. And the number of dangers that were expressed by that group, by even just showing up to this thing, and this was, like, a continental conference, so about 35 countries were represented. And there is serious danger for people that want to change the system or report you know, injustices or whatever they even want to report on, from whether it's their perspective as a woman, even in some cases. How do you navigate those sensitivities from a teaching perspective? Obviously, everybody has a story to tell in some case, mm-hmm. but yes, the journalism tactics of like, this is how you craft a story, but here's how you, you know, survive.
Yeah, so there's a few things I've noticed. The more stable a country is, the more you can do like a group program. Like, all right, we'll have an after school program and 20 students will go and they'll learn journalism and tell their story, and some will pursue media careers, some won't. That's fine. But then like the more danger you have and the more unstable a place is, the higher the risks, obviously. And what I found remarkable is that there are people within those communities who view themselves as the storytellers and the ones who hold the powerful to account.
Right.
And they just exist. Like, no one said, hey, you can be a journalist, kid. You want to get in the newspapers? They're just kind of intrinsic within human society. And those people are like far braver than, you know, I and most people I know. But they've like established that. Of particular note are the journalists in Mogadishu.
Right.
Who've just determined that they're going to die as a journalist, and it's such an accepted fact.
Right.
And like when I'm like trying to like communicate like, you know, story structure or like here's how this would look in English, it, like they've made that determination and they're learning English to help
right.
get the word out of what's going on. I'm just kind of, I can offer expertise I have, and for the students who aren't quite as hardcore as a Somali journalist in Mogadishu, my kind of guiding principle is that the stories that will get someone beaten up or thrown in jail are the stories that will cost someone money. So I try to never like do vicarious reporting, like, hey, wouldn't it be great if you wrote about that shipment of missiles that was going out late at night? Like,
right.
Whoa, that would be a great story. No, and a lot of kind of just, this is what life is like in my home stories
okay.
have profound power around the world, particularly for somewhere like Africa, which, you know, it's this vast, heterogeneous, massive, wonderful, horrifying, fantastic place, but it's still like conceived of as Africa.
Right.
Right. But it's, I think it's what, 54 countries, and
yeah.
within those 54 countries, they all have dozens and dozens at least
it's
of cultures.
Incredible
and
place,
da, da, da.
Yeah.
So just by like saying, oh, I'm a Rwandan and here's how I make my living, it's like, oh, wow. Like one story that came to mind was there are these seamstresses in Kigali, the capital of Rwanda, and they do the foot pedal sewing.
Right.
And it's just like a little shop, I think like five female employees, stuff like that. And I was showing it to a guy who grew up in Alabama, and he was like, oh, that's just like Birmingham when I was a kid. It was like that. So Rwanda today
yeah.
was like 70 year ago America. And like that was like a really cool connection.
Well, that's interesting too.
And considered, and yeah,
because you said, I mean, even when you were kind of rattling off the list of places, and I wrote this down, you're like, and South Central, and like, you know, these places that are right around the corner from us, but you're also going to, you know, these far regions of the world. What are some of the similarities you see in terms of, you know, homegrown storytelling, at least from the Drew Tiziano Project perspective?
The regions that don't like share the story, it's often from an external thing of like, oh, I can't tell the story. And it's like, of course you can. Like, here's a smartphone and download your Instagram app and build
right.
a following and whatever. But there's just a belief, I guess. It's the belief of my inability to alter this situation or also a lack of faith that like someone will come and help. And another example of this is, I've taught journalism on Skid Row in downtown LA, and I've done a few programs, but the one I did more recently was, there's this group of people who are working full time and they're in family units, but they're just completely broke.
Right.
And so they live in kind of, I think like four families to a unit with a shared kitchen type of thing.
Wow.
And so I was trying to it was all going pretty well, and the student was doing a fantastic job and he really learned reporting, and I was trying to connect him to a UCLA scholarship, which is like worth about like what, 200 grand, like a full ride
yeah.
through UCLA, and he just didn't believe that like there was more money available to pay for his education than he had ever seen in his entire life.
Right.
And again, that's a belief, and it's a belief that's been really hammered in through experience. But those beliefs and like what's possible and what's out there that are kind of externally.
Yeah. How do you is there a method that you've discovered to help bridge that gap? Because I totally get it, right? Like, you know, I feel like in a lot of communities like that, it's like you don't know what you don't know. And when you skip that, you know, the second level, you're like, really? Like, it's like Mars, right. Pretty much. And like, I know, like, hood-wise, you talk about South Central. And, like, if you talk about Hollywood to somebody in South Central, which is probably, what, 15, 20 minutes away, mm-hmm. It sounds like a distant, far-off land, never been there in my life, or I've never been to the beach, even though like it's right there. So I don't know, as far as bridging that gap between possibility and belief systems.
My personal thing is to kind of show by example, and that's generally through personal mentorship, and just like always I try to like check in with most of my former students on a weekly basis, and then their small success. It's similar to how I train for boxing, or most people train for boxing. You build up on small skill sets, and once someone has a smaller success, you can't take that away from them. Like, oh, you got published in your local newspaper. Like,
right.
That's there. Like, oh, I've done that. And it's like, all right, what can we do next? And it's like, oh, you've published two stories, and then those two stories had multiple sources. And like, oh, you see, like, you're not that different from the pros.
Right.
Like, you can kind of see how your intelligence matches their intelligence. And one of the things I like about journalism and the chaos it's going through is that anyone can get in now, right? So as long as you have the ethic and the integrity and you go for it,
right,
you're pretty much on par with the people who have the deck stacked in their favor. And so that's my personal methodology, is to try to lead by example and then really kind of vaunt and showcase every gradual success and have an idea of what the person's kind of arc of their becoming could be.
Right.
All right, this will be your first victory, your second victory. Oop, you'll have a little thing there, but we'll get over that. Third, fourth, fifth, sixth. And then it's like, hey, you're eligible for the scholarship now. You want to go for it? You know, something like that.
Nice. So tell me about this wardrobe of yours, which is awesome.
Well, thank you.
we're going to get a picture of it, but just so you guys know, it's like there's a vest, a pocket square down with the vest. It's all plaid, and you're like, you're three pieced up without the third piece. But I don't know. Like, is this your everyday style? Like, what?
Yes, sir, it is.
What's the Drew McGregor style for, methodology of style?
Yeah. So I'm really big. I'm about, almost 6'10" and 290 pounds of me, and so I had to give an important speech for this event called TEDx USC a few years ago. That's kind of like a regional TED event, and the one in USC was like their big flagship thing. Anyway, so I was like, oh, I have to give the speech, and so I have a friend who's a costume designer, and I was like, I need a suit.
Where you went, costume design?
Right, and so she's like, all right. So she's got all these like great local contacts of people she uses for the TV shows and movies she makes costumes for.
Right.
So she like, we had a day, I treated her to sushi, and she like, we went around to downtown to like, I think B&B and Sons, and got the fabric, and then got the,
which is a lot of fabric.
It is. It's about 5 yards for a shirt, and then I think it was more for the suit. And then we like went around, and there are all these, it's what I love about LA is you have all these great artists who can kind of do right. amazing things. And then we had the first suit, and the speech went well, and I was like, whoa. And being big, I can't like get off the shelf stuff anyway, and I was just like, "Well, now I can."
Because big and tall stuff, you just look like a giant Steve Harvey.
Here's your muumuu. Like,
right?
Do you have a
just put this sheet on? Wait, that's the racist.
Do you have a business casual muumuu?
Business casual muumuu.
And so it was liberating, and it's not actually more expensive than off the shelf stuff. So I was just like, "Oh man, I can wear anything I want." And then the world of fashion became this like vibrant tapestry, and I was like, well, let's do it. So then, I just started. Anytime I had like another important speech to give, I'd like make another suit for it through with this methodology.
That's pretty awesome. Tommy. I want to take a peek into your closet one day. Yeah. Just I probably can't fit anything, but just to see. Why did you make a robot?
Why did I make a robot? Okay, so while I was doing conflict photography for a bit, and you see kids who've lost limbs and have been blown up, and you're like, well, that's terrible. And then, but it's like, what can you do about it? Because landmines are these horrible things, and there's like, they're there, and they're impenetrable, and they're right. terrifying. And it's like, just like imagine being a child and afraid of the earth you walk on growing up. Like, go down that kind of empathy thing. And then so that just it bothered me. I was like, God, how come these things are still killing children from the, like, conflicts that ended decades ago? And so a bit after that, a few years, I was asked to be a judge on this thing called the Robot Film Festival. And the Robot Film Festival seeks to showcase benevolent human-machine interactions. Like, one of their slogans is, what if Skynet loved us? You know, like, we'd have we'd have a different Terminator film. Hey, humans, get along, and I'll help you get along. And I was really moved by that ethos. And so I wrote a short film that was based on this organization called Apopo, which trains rats to sniff for landmines. People use dogs usually, but dogs are cost like tens of thousands of dollars to train them. They're trained in Germany, and then they're subject to tropical diseases. Oh, geez. But, you know, rats can be, quote-unquote, locally sourced.
Yeah, rats, they can survive anywhere.
Yeah, and they're just like, oh, I'm a rat.
Next would be roaches searching for...
We could.
Yeah, see?
Yeah, let's rehabilitate.
Roach training program. Mm. It's my Kickstarter.
So in the short film, the robot... works with a rat. It's a love story between a rat and a robot, and they guide humans out of a minefield. And then my idea was to kind of make the movie and have it be an inspiration to engineers, because I think narrative really is important to engineers, even though they don't kind of create it. But it was like Star Trek inspired people to make a tricorder now. Like, that's one of the X prizes.
Yes.
Like the tricorder X prize, and that's from the Star Trek thing. So, like, taking that in mind, I was like, what if we could make a movie that would inspire engineers to help solve the landmine crisis? And in the process of making the movie, we had a kind of functional prototype.
Were you thinking about that when you wrote the script? Were you thinking like, I wonder if somebody will read this and an engineer will make it?
Yes, that was like the kind of the intention.
All right, then. Well done. Yes. Continue.
And then doing a movie, we had two roboticists and like me, and then my producer had worked in Cambodia a while, and we had this prototype. So it was just kind of like, let's just do this. And then I turned it into an organization that does advocacy education in robotics. And I've come to kind of learn robotics through this, even though I didn't have a specific engineering background. And it's like a fascinating, wonderful world. So now I'm probably going to be testing this robot that came from that movie with the rats.
Does the robot have a name?
Piper.
Oh.
Yeah, right?
It's
adorable.
Yeah, it is. Well, and what was the rat's name?
I haven't named the rat.
Oh, okay. That's fine. Unnecessary at this point.
No, because it does like call forth all sorts of odds.
Is Piper, which one is the male and female?
Right. It's like, do you have to have a gender? Like,
yeah.
Like, what would robots look like if we could conceive of ourselves
without
genders?
They were anthropomorphic?
Things like that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of going along, and it's basically, wouldn't it be nice to have $1,000 robot that can help map landmine fields? And that's what this thing is. And it's coming into existence now, and it's all from that kind of screenplay.
I don't understand your capacity. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's you're obviously a high energy individual, and stature wise, you're large. So, you know, but the ability to achieve these multiple levels of success of multiple moving parts of multiple projects and companies.
Uh-huh.
Is there a technique or what's your sort of, source of existence?
I love my friends and, like, you know, this isn't like I'm the one man band.
Sure.
Like, there's everything we're describing has involved the effort of, you know, thousands of people, to a certain point. So yeah, I love doing things with friends and I do things communally, and then it just so happens I'm just like, wow, we can turn this community into like a longer term thing.
And when did, like, you know, what do you, I would imagine there's, in between the successes, there have been some starts and fits of other things.
Mm-hmm.
How do you gauge when to continue with something, right?
Yeah.
Or you spot potential in something, or maybe you spotted potential in a thought and it's just not working out the way you thought it would.
Mm-hmm.
Do you continue to try and fix that thing, or do you move on to the next? Like, what's your filtering process?
That's something I've had to learn, and I'm finally just kind of getting the hang of it, of like the non-banging one's head in the wall. And basically what it is you need to learn when this something is no longer your personal, like, even 50% passion.
Right.
And then who could do my job better than me? And then talk to that person who I feel could do the job better than me to replace me in my position. Like, I view it like now I view it as a huge success that I have all these hats on my head, and every time I can give a hat away, that's a triumph, right? That's a triumph of success because right. It means an institution is developing, and the hat that's given away is the seed that will make that institution grow
and
grow.
It's like the Tom's model of entrepreneurship. You get a hat, give a hat. You get a hat when you start the thing.
But it's my hat I'm giving away. It's not the Tom's thing of like, well, we have the shoddy shoe that we get to.
They're doing backpacks now for bullying.
Backpacks for bullying?
Yes.
I think bullies have enough resources.
Exactly. Touché, sir. That's interesting. How hard of a lesson was that for you to learn as far as, you know, because it's your baby, you know, and it's like right. you're giving it away and entrusting it with.
And this, I learned a lot of this from boxing. It's ultimately about your vanity. You know, it's like, am I my company? Because it's me. And no, it's not. It never was you. It was always the community. And what I was able to offer was like inspiration, a bit of chutzpah. But it's ultimately be the community tribe, however you want to phrase it,
right.
that kind of makes things go forward together in the long run. And that was just kind of overcoming a lot of the tech propaganda of like, these are the idols.
Right.
Worship them. They have made our world. And it's like, they're good. They're great.
Right.
But they do require teams of thousands of people to
right.
implement a vision. And what is your role as a leader? What is your role stepping back from leadership and knowing when your talents have kind of reached their capacity?
What is your, I don't know, your superpower as a leader?
I make other superheroes.
I just tweeted that the other day. I said, true power is making others feel, is the ability to make others powerful.
You're precocious. Yeah.
Precocious?
No, it is.
Right.
Yeah, that's kind of how I view it. I'm just like, you're a superhero, but you have this like psychological weight on you. It's like, let's remove that weight. And it's like, see the amazing things you're now doing. Like, yes, let's rock.
Look at me. It's like you're starting to glow and just looking at your hands. You mentioned thousands or tens of thousands of people, and all these people, some of them I would imagine need to be paid.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you go about sourcing, funding, and, you know, really doing the business side of the creative idea?
That's still an issue. We're not at the point yet. Like the Titan Project, for example, is currently in hibernation.
Right.
Because we had come to be on a grant-by-grant business model. And as a not-for-profit, that's really difficult for
right.
like a long-term thing. So that's currently in hibernation, and a lot of the team are like going on running other things and doing spectacular stuff. So beyond like independent wealth kind of doing that,
sure.
I'm not quite sure what the model would be for new media journalism, but lots of other people have wondered this
yeah.
as well. Yeah, it's just finding the right model for each one. But
right.
nothing we're discussing is like funded at a level where I'm like, yeah, this is great.
No, I just, just this idea of like, okay, yes, there are these highs and lows in terms of success or just people jumping on board as a passion, you know, opportunity and empowering those people to have the experience of working with the Tiziano Project, which I've heard about for years, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Mar Abrams is a good friend
incredible.
Of mine.
Yeah.
And so she first mentioned it to me, and then it was like this domino effect. Like everywhere I was going, I was like, what is this thing? So thank you for explaining it. You've mentioned boxing a few times.
Uh-huh.
So how did you come into boxing?
Because
you don't need to fight anybody. Like
right.
you can.
Tired of being picked on, man.
Get you one of those backpacks.
I got a bit traumatized after doing some photojournalism in Eastern Congo, and I came back to LA, and kind of the nature of my trauma, I think people would call it PTSD, but I call it shell shock, is that my emotional spectrum had shifted. So if it wasn't like a kid waving a gun at me, I just couldn't feel anything. And this really...
Wait, so there were kids waving guns at you?
There were kids waving guns at
okay.
me, yeah. And far worse things than that. And so what this did was I was just like completely desensitized, and I would like be with friends and they're watching some movie or something, they're laughing, I would fake the laughter. And when that happens,
it's like when people listen to the show, by the way.
Right. It makes it worse. And then I knew something was wrong, and it wasn't like a conventional therapy thing, like, well, my mother didn't love me enough, so I'm going to talk to you about this, doctor. And I had heard about the sport of chess boxing before, and I already could play chess, so I was just like, I'm doing this. And when I do something, I search for a hero.
Now, so, how good are you at chess? Is it like, are you?
I'm very good. I'm attempting to become a master, and then I'm treating it like a martial art. So I do like daily training now and stuff like that.
Nice.
The upper percentiles of humanity, I'm in there. So I ended up like writing an email to George Foreman. And I just like went to his website, like, here's what I'm trying to do. Again, when you're like in that emotional condition, you'll do things like, right. That makes sense to me. Anyway, so George wrote back this like very concise, wonderful 3-paragraph thing of how one becomes a champion boxer. I'm like, wow. So when George Foreman like sends you an email, it's just like an act of some.
Have you framed
power.
That and put it anywhere? Like,
I haven't framed it yet because it is an email form. It's not him, but yeah, it's so, I cherish
same
it.
Difference.
Right. Anyway, so like part of George's thing was. Go find a great trainer. So I'm like, oh, great trainer. So I do a little Google thing and come across a wild card gym in Hollywood, which is where Pacquiao trains and all that, which I didn't know any of this at the time.
$5 a day, right?
Isn't it? So I go up there, and the person I speak to first is actually Freddie Roach, who's Pacquiao's trainer, and I don't know who he is. And I'm just like, I'm here to chess box. Where you like move
Is the manager
around.
Here?
And he's like, rah, rah, and he like points me to this other trainer. I'm like, I'm here to chess box. Like, all right. And the fighting community was like really great, and I just started training. And then when I started to spar, I still remember the moment I got hit in the ribs and I felt pain again. And it was such a relief, like coming out of the ocean after you've almost drowned. Like, I can feel again. And then I just kept it up. And that wasn't like a complete, recovery or anything, but it was like much, much better than feeling nothing and being damaged in that way. And then this guy flew in from Germany. There are a few organizations that do chess boxing around the world.
Right.
And we fought. And I won by checkmate in the 5th round. And the LA Times sent 4 reporters. And they put me on Carson Daly right away. And it became a thing. And I realized that kind of the nature of how I had come into the sport is something I could share. So for further events, we would do like chess boxing for charity. My fighting moniker is the fighting philanthropist, right?
Right.
And so that's what we do. And it's a movement. And it's really beautiful to see it kind of grow and be beyond me now. And like it's going to be taught in elementary school in the fall. And because people see it's like utility of mixing kind of the aggression with the contemplation and focus of a chess.
Well, also, boxing is a very cerebral sport. I think most people don't realize that. Like Sugar Ray Leonard was a guest on the show, and he's fantastic, right? And shameless plug to previous episodes, guys.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a really brilliant sport. Even more so. I've been a martial artist for years, and like I would say, even because it's a little bit more calculating than most things. So like, what do you see as the? I don't know whether it's a cerebral bridge or just a spirit. I don't know how you connect the two practices in the same moment.
In terms of the prep, they both require obsessive discipline. I think that's something they have in common. And in the moment, it's the art of it is switching between the two. Because in the case of boxing, if you're thinking, then you're going to get smashed in the head.
Right.
Because it creates a brief disconnect between your mind and your body. Like, he's going to throw a left hook. Yes, I can see his shoulders moving. Yes, I was right. He's going to throw. Right? But for the chess, you need to not be pure instinct and kind of move into the chess frame of mind. And that's a different state. And so you do like what I've learned through all this experience is you do this like, and so I teach you like in the nose, out the mouth,
mm-hmm.
and like really lower your heart rate, just kind of like you would see in a samurai film, same thing.
Right.
And then you're on the chessboard and then you do your chess round and then you return to the boxing and then you have to get back into that instinct mode. I was fortunate enough to train with a world champion named Lehman Brewster, and he kind of took my boxing to the point where it was jazz, where you learn these techniques through repetition, but if you do the same move over and over, your opponent will read that and then counter your move.
Right.
So what he taught me was to kind of like imprint that through like doing the same move once or twice and then switch up for the third. So it was almost like improvisational jazz from instinct with these kind of techniques that he had learned from his trainers and stuff like that. And that's when that boxing became like the art of it. Granted, one can get severely damaged before that thing occurs. Yes. So that's
Most jazz musicians don't end up with brain damage.
Right. And that's always been a thing because you'll see like these punchy fighters at the gym. It's just like, oh man. But yeah, like the champs and the people who have great defense are kind of fine.
So what outside of the the PTSD or shell shock kind of therapeutic application of what you experience, have you been able to apply any of what you've learned through chess boxing in your other endeavors, right? You know, are there any principles of the game where you learn to be aggressive or, you know, more, you know, cerebral or, you know, how do you apply the sciences to your, you know, your business practices?
Yeah, like nothing's as bad as it seems in the business world, right? Like it just isn't because you're not being hit in the face, right? It's just like, all right, we'll get through this round.
Right.
And once we're through this round, we need to refocus our business. And that's similar to the contemplation of chess, or it's like, okay, we just went through something bad. It was a whirlwind. We got hit.
Right.
What are we going to do now? Because we're still here, and I think we can improve our position, and we can come together as a unit far better than we could previously. And then that kind of the chess part of it. And I'm always trying to go for a checkmate in my chess game, because for me it's like doing math at the end of a gun in public. It's just like it's uncomfortable and I want to win as quickly as possible.
Right.
That might affect my long-term strategic thinking, but I think it's pretty useful, particularly for like a post quote-unquote crisis thing in the business world. So it just makes you like tougher and more agile and more confident that things will be okay.
Right.
And I think that gets shared with the organization. Like, all right, come on, we can get through this. it's not like
get up, get up off the ground, stop crying.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, I mean, through all these endeavors, and I know we probably have only touched a small percentage of them, what do you want people to know Andrew McGregor for?
What, like a
kind of like a, I don't know, like
Epithet Tombstone style.
Like, yes, here lies.
I was here.
Exactly.
And so will you be. No.
I want my tombstone to say, not really did.
Or like dot, dot, dot.
To be continued. But no, like.
LOL.
Exactly. Or we'll return in 5 minutes. Uh-huh. Just leave a sign on. No, but like, I don't know. If. Because you've encountered so many people, you know, I had a conversation on the phone a little bit earlier. We were talking about like, oh, you know, what does this company or this individual want to leave as a legacy, right? Mm-hmm. You know, another way of phrasing it, I would say something like, you know, what do you want people to take from you, you know, with an Andrew McGregor encounter? What do you want people to walk away with, whether it's you directly or an encounter with one of your, you know, projects and endeavors?
I want them to take away, and I think this often happens, like, I can do this. I can do it.
Right.
It's like, oh, wow, you brought chess boxing to North America and, like, are now teaching it in schools. It's like, that's absurd. And
right.
Like, if you can do that absurd thing, like, oh, I can totally do my third-party vending machine mobile play. Like, that won't be a problem. You know, it's like,
right.
Whatever your dream is, like, I can do it. Yes. Yes,
and
I can do it.
How much of what you attribute to your success is serendipitous? Because a lot of it is like, oh, I walked in this thing and then this thing happened. Like it right. Just kind of magically came together versus the, you know, being deliberate and saying, all right, we need to do X, Y, and Z, right? I think that's also where that aggression comes in versus like the relaxed and responsive version of yourself.
Yeah, being in Los Angeles is pretty helpful for that. There's a kind of scrappy entrepreneurial nature to a lot of this city that's predicated on the film industry, right? Because I have this belief that major industries affect their metropolitan areas, like Wall Street kind of defines New York in a lot of ways. That's
right.
Like DC, the nature of the industry is power, right? And then so LA is the entertainment industry, and within the entertainment industry, it's a project by project thing, basically.
Sure.
Unless you're like accounting at Warner Brothers, your jobs end like every 6 months and
yeah.
You need to look for work again. So within like that scrappiness, it's like, hey guys, we can do this. And it's not as big of a deal to like start a company as it would be in like the Midwest or.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. Cause I grew up in Detroit and you know, my first job out of college, I worked at Chrysler And I remember when I was like, I'm going to go to L.A. and there were men who had been there for like 15, 20 or more years and looked at me like I was like a blue turtle. Like it's like, what? You're going to leave? You sure? I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure. But I experienced exactly what you're talking about, right? Like, you know, when I got my first writing job, there was one day we went in to pick up our checks. And there was a letter stapled to the check, and all the writing staff had been let go. And it was like, don't come in on Monday. Like, really? They're like, you can fire people like this? And, you know, the only way to survive is to, you know, figure out what you're going to, because you want to eat, right? And, like, you may take that thing that's interesting or cool or whatever just to tide you over. And some people get stuck. Like, I don't know if, and not to derail or anything, but I know some people get stuck in that accounting job because they, you know, they were an actor or, you know, some creative spirit and they had an accounting skill and they moved to LA to, you know, flex the creative side, but then they get stuck. I don't know if you've experienced that, like in the people that you've come across and if there's any like techniques, you're like, hey, here's how to get out of it.
Yeah. LA can be pretty harsh, but also pretty wonderful. And I just, when I've seen people kind of do that, and it's ultimately kind of a loss of faith. And you know, maybe you weren't supposed to be Johnny Depp, and that just wasn't in the cards.
Right.
But then,
I don't even think Johnny Depp was supposed to be Johnny Depp.
Right. It's just like, whoa. Like, how did this happen? Like, shh.
Exactly.
Keith Richards, don't ruin this for me.
Wait, along those lines, there was a thing about Michael Cera, and it said he looks like a guy who showed up at an audition with his friend, and he didn't tell the guys that he was not an actor, and he just kept going with it. It's like, he's that guy. I thought that story was going to be funnier than it was. Mm. Continue.
Oh, right. So as long as you're doing your craft or your art with complete integrity, you know, like the city will be kind to you and reward you. Like I went with chess boxing with extreme discipline, just as if, which I kind of now am like a pro fighter, and that's my career trajectory. And because of that, the fighting community embraced the concept.
Right.
And like supported it and like participated. And if I hadn't done it with that integrity, like, because I've met with people around the country are like, hey, I want to do a chess boxing club. I'm like, all right.
Like, just punch them in the face.
You're going to need to fight. And they're like, well, they just like kind of want to let go and hang out at a gym and suggest it. And the people at the gym are like, what are you talking about? Like, but if you actually like do it and you have that integrity about it, then you're going to get those results.
Right.
And you just have to not be afraid of like, failure is the wrong word, but of like not becoming that thing. You have to have the knowledge that as long as you're doing your art, you are that thing, and that the money and quote unquote success that you're wanting or not wanting or think you deserve more of is separate and in some ways irrelevant to you going at your art with the integrity the art deserves and that you deserve to be within that realm.
It's supremely well said. And I don't think I've ever used the word supremely on this show, except the time I ordered a pizza.
Oh, yeah.
So the show's called Innovation Crush. Mm. What do you see out in the world that you are kind of personally crushing on that you're, you know, that you may want to even put a new hat on yourself?
There's a magical thing I'm doing now called Good Bar, and it's a philanthropic bar. So it functions just like a normal bar, except all the revenue goes to mostly local charities. We're trying to make it so it can be scaled as a chain. So like, you know, you would go to your normal happy hour, except you're supporting your community that way.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So we're starting with a series of pop-up events, in LA, in downtown LA this September. And we're going to seg the pop-up events into a brick and mortar place. And the pop-up events are being done with a gallery called Think Tank. And the idea is it will grow the community to the point where, we can then launch a brick-and-mortar Good Bar. The first one being in downtown is kind of a proof-of-concept business. And then we can just have these, like, charitable fundraising machines kind of pop up wherever.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. That's the new hat.
Let's steal that idea.
Go for it.
You already signed the release form. I'm signing away my ideas. No, that's fascinating. So what I wanted to ask you also, what do you consider – your biggest success so far?
Just the community and the people I've known. That's the beautiful part for me, is that I've been able to interact with so many courageous, brilliant, wonderful, self-sacrificing, amazing people in the world, that those people exist and that I've been able to even like talk to them, much less collaborate on a huge
right.
caper is really meaningful to me. And I just cherish that daily and almost every minute. Yeah.
And speaking of collaboration, I read that you, a few years ago, you were working with the RZA on a sub-brand of the...
Working with might not be the way to put it.
You sent him an email and asked him a question.
No, I didn't do that. there's an organization called the Hip Hop Chess Federation that does work with the RZA, and they're based in the Bay Area. And they're similar-ish. They do kind of martial arts and chess training for people in difficult neighborhoods, and they put on this kind of celebrity chess tournament, and I got to play there's an actor from like Sons of Anarchy and stuff like that.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it's cool. And then RZA was there, and so we met, and we were supposed to kind of work on doing chess jujitsu and kind of expanding that,
right?
And then RZA had a art exhibit at the World Chess Hall of Fame in St. Louis, and so yeah, there was like a similar movement, but I wasn't like, hey, Mr. RZA, what are we doing today? So, but yeah, just kind of like similar things of using chess and martial arts to benefit communities that need it. And we're still on that path, but directly.
You know, hanging out with the Wu-Tang Clan is what did just pretty, you know.
Not since the chess tournament, no.
By the way, Method Man was in the Amy Schumer movie. You should check that out.
Oh, okay.
It was a weird cameo, but it worked.
He's just like, why are you dressed as an owl?
Exactly. He was like a nurse with a Jamaican accent. Spoiler alert. Has nothing to do with the story.
It ruins the catharsis.
Complete this phrase for me, please.
Yes.
Innovation to me is...
sharing our integrity.
Elaborate. Sharing our integrity.
Because there are a lot of things that people can do well, and I think up till now, there historically the model was like patent things and get the IP. Like if you examine the Microsoft Corporation, right?
Right.
And the way they handle themselves and like, you know, licensing Windows OSs and blah, blah, blah. And now they're forced really to go open source.
Right.
And it's about sharing that thing. But the thing that they've done required a lot of integrity to get there. And so I do think if people perceive themselves as educators, life becomes much more fun and convivial. And so, but the integrity part is like what people take pride in, what they've learned, be you a software engineer or an elementary school teacher or like a public policy person. And so if you can share that integrity, you're sharing what's sacred and what you believe in. And I think it helps the individual express what's sacred to them, but also benefits someone else from kind of granting or blessing or sharing their integrity. Yeah, sharing their integrity.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been awesome. How can people find you on the interwebs or in the streets?
My website is mightykingdrew.com. I'm not terribly active on Twitter, but you can reach out to me there with at mightykingdrew. And yeah, or you can like check out the various organizations and things like that. But yeah, that's the way.
Mighty King Drew.
Yeah.
Thank you, man. This has been awesome. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
It was lovely. Thank you.
Maria, did you enjoy yourself?
I did.
Okay, great. Anybody? And there's nobody else in here. Everyone, this has been another amazing installment of Innovation Crush, and we will talk to you next time.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore. Because it's here. And it's funny. And I love you.